This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
As I was walking Kinhin around this little room, I thought how wonderful it is that there's this opportunity in a different way, the way of movement, where we can be alert. We can know what we're doing, keeping our minds on our alertness, as we read today in Shantideva. So I'd like to say a few words about that, about our reading today. And so I think one thing that comes up for me about guarding alertness, there's a kind of a renunciation in being mindful and being alert and really paying attention to what we're doing right now in this moment, instead of going on to the next thing, particularly in our culture, which is so on to the next thing, and leaves us often, and it's kind of designed that way in certain respects, to feel kind of restlessness and unfulfilledness. So when we have the chance to be, to do these practices of sitting and walking, it's a great place to really focus on guarding alertness. And so then when we bring the bodhicitta part in, we have a good foundation for that. So one thing that the alertness, the mindfulness, and being aware of it, it lets us get to know really deeper and deeper where we are in our body minds. And this goes on. Doesn't matter how many years you practiced or how few or how, what age you are. It just keeps going on developing as long as you're opening, if you will, as long as you're willing to stay with it. I was also struck by the hallucinations that really made an impression on me, of how we make up these stories in our minds and how actually the world we could say of samsara, but also the world we live in, has plenty of hallucinations to show us. So kind of brings up a doubting mind, often, that those hallucinations. I recall a poem by an American woman poet, Muriel Rukeyser, who lived in the Second World War. She was a young woman then, and she wrote a powerful poem called The Overthrow of 1 o'clock at Night, kind of alluding to those hallucinations that come in the middle of the night. And but she specifically brought in this very dharmic and bodhicitta way, the events that were unfolding half a world away from her, where children, and she has very eloquently, I won't quote the whole poem, but she talks of how the children are calling to us from half a world away. They are our children that are being rained on by fire. So kind of bombings and those things go on to this day. And she ends with, which is a kind of call to mindfulness and back to herself, a kind of trusting herself. And she says, "Alone, all my hopes scattered, in people a quarter of a world away, half a world away, a way out of hearing. I tell myself, trust. Trust in experience, in the deep rhythms of experience. So calling back to herself that place of, she wasn't using the language of bodhicitta, but that Shantidevas calls us to. Remember that place where we have the aspiration and where why we're called here to be together and to practice. So I think that's what Buddha did. He trusted in his experience. He had a memory, so experience can be a memory. Memory's a little tricky, but actually that's one translation of sati, is just remembering, just recollecting, to recall ourselves back, and particularly the sense of that deep place within us. So the Buddha went through, as long, many of you know those stories, went through a lot of hallucinations before he woke up. And those were Mara appearing in many frightening and horrible guises, and beguiling guises as well. But he remembered this experience he had of being really centered and at peace when he was a young child sitting under a tree and watching his father direct the work in the fields. So we have those experiences. We also may have very painful experiences. So recollecting those in a kind of tranquility and with patience can be very empowering for us, can call us back to remember our vows of bodhicitta, of being with all things, saving all beings. So the hallucinations can take us into a serious doubting mind, which is one of the hindrances or kleshas in Buddhism, which is considered by many in many different Buddhist traditions, the early ones particularly, one of the most difficult states of mind to be in. So that can really throw us completely off track if we let that take over, self-doubt or doubt in the Dharma, doubt in the or any aspect of the Dharma, doubt in bodhicitta, doubt in our vows. I think in Zen it's called rolling up the mat. Sometimes we just go away. We don't really believe that we can do it, or that it even is real sometimes. So I wanted to touch on anger too, because one aspect of it, as our verses today tied anger and patience so together. What do we do when we're angry with ourselves? You know, when we're telling ourselves a story, because that can be a place that goes to doubting mind, and remembering, it's like anger, what Shantideva says about anger. It's just anger is arising, or doubt is arising. It's just another thing that's arising. And we don't have to believe it. We do not have to believe it. We don't have to believe doubt. We don't have to believe anger. In fact, in early Buddhism, that's called, and perhaps in Zen, and I don't know the stories, it's called shooting the second arrow into the first arrow. So you're angry, you're doubtful, and then you just get mad at yourself and just compound the problem. But remembering that's not who we are. That's why we practice, to remember there's much more to us. There's a deeper part of us, as all human beings have this, and to remember not only us, but everyone, has many more deep depth, much more depth than we think when we just say anger arises or that person's doing something or those people are doing something. So that gets us into those good, bad binaries. And it's good if we can turn away from those and just perhaps focus on the suffering and not suffering piece. So I wanted to talk some about patience, and I want to apologize for selecting, I don't know exactly why I'm apologizing, actually. There's so much in here that we just don't have the time to do all. And as the week goes on, we're reading more and more verses from each chapter, but patience particularly has really a lot of verses. So there are many practice opportunities in patience, and you can, I hope you're all interested in going back to or taking up reading or rereading Shantideva. And at the end of Sesshin, Shika and Nico has made a copy of the freely available PDF, which is Stephen Batchelor's, and that's the first one I began with years ago. And so these verses that I'm discussing and that we're reading are just kind of touching the surface of patience, which is a huge practice. So we focus today in our readings and contemplations, people really noticed that that connection between anger and patience. They really picked up on that. Relying on patience, such a friend to us, patience. So I'll just read that one again. There is no evil greater than anger and no virtue greater than patience. Therefore, I should strive in various ways to become familiar with the practice of patience. And I remember when I first began practicing Buddha Dharma that I knew that I was impatient in certain ways and, you know, had identified some of those ways, but I did not think of myself as a particularly impatient person, and I wasn't given that feedback either. But when I started really looking and bringing mindful and attention, and as Shantideva urges us to look and look again, I just was like, oh my goodness, I am really impatient. All these impatiences, the tiniest things that, you know, that they kind of slip through when you're not really mindful, that you don't even kind of realize you're impatient. But so, and those all have an effect. I mean, in a way, Shantideva, Michael said that the other day, is like, he's just so practical and down to earth. It's just like you, so just start with the little steps and keep on doing those. We will get to the big stuff, emptiness, but we build up to it. Shantideva builds up to it. And I mean, we even know this from our training as children, hopefully, that, you know, our mothers and fathers told us, you know, hold your tongue or take a deep breath and, you know, things like that. So I'd like to read a few more that we didn't get to today and let's see. I should always rejoice in others' happiness and virtue. This joy causes my virtue to increase. Moreover, it is the cause of delighting the holy beings and the supreme method for benefiting others. So there is a practice to delight in others' happiness and virtue, the supreme method for benefiting others. And I think perhaps we read anger at, yes, we did read that. Why getting angry do we throw away our merit? It brings no benefit to us or to others. But here are a few more that we didn't get to. Sort of amplifying, there was one that we did read, but these sort of amplify, each one has another subtle resonance that we can tune into. And each of us being individuals with our own conditioning might find some more helpful than others. Those who cause me suffering are like Buddhas bestowing their blessings. Since they lead me to liberating paths, why should I get angry with them? And he's talking to himself here. Don't they obstruct your virtuous practice? No, there is no virtuous practice greater than patience. Therefore, I will never get angry with those who cause me suffering. If, because of my own shortcomings, I do not practice patience with my enemy, it is not he, but I, who prevent me from practicing patience, which is the cause of accumulating merit. So I'll read one more here. Along with myself, my enemy is the cause of my practicing patience. Therefore, I should first dedicate whatever fruits arise from this practice to the person who was a cause of it. So actually identifying your enemies and dedicating the merit to them. And the enemies, I think, can be, we can find without too much trouble. At least I don't have any trouble. If we look in the political realm, you know, if we look in the world of samsara, there are plenty of people that we, or groups that we put in that good bad place, or that we could call our enemy. And what if we actually did practices? Tom brought in this morning, it's we're practicing practice with this. What if we brought in practices of on occasion in our zazen practice, actually bringing to mind those who we are having difficulty with, and feeling into the bodhicitta of that they are giving us a cause for practicing patience and merit and developing our bodhicitta, bringing the visual image of the person. It could be a person in your life, or it could be a person that you don't know. Someone that arouses strong feelings of enmity, you know, someone you don't really want to spend a lot of time with, or don't enjoy spending time with when you have to, as it happens in life. We often need to spend time with people we may not particularly enjoy, or maybe not often, but sometimes anyway. So that can be a very opening way of developing, generating bodhicitta. Remember when we talked about at the beginning, the generator Paula talked about, actually, that chapter 3 of generating bodhicitta and the benefits. So I remember one time I did that during the during the buildup to the Iraq War and took on the president at that time, whom I had a real antipathy for. And it was kind of easy to bring him to mind because political figures are all over and kind of in our face if we keep up with them at all with what's going on in our world. So it can be very powerful. You can really get in touch with how deeply you're holding these thorns in you, these thorns of anger, and how by practicing bodhicitta and generating it, you can pull out the thorn. Like you can reach, when you get a thorn in your finger, you're clipping the roses or whatever, you pull it out, or a thorn in the paw of your dog or your cat. There's a kind of a positive way you can do this too. It's a little more aligned to say metta practice, where actually I found this very powerful practice too. As a practice every day, that whenever I went out anywhere, and I was going out a lot more than we are now in the pandemic, anyone I would meet, I would remember that they too are a human being who wishes happiness and wants to be free from suffering. And you can say that very simply, like, may they be happy, may they be at ease, which is what we chant in the Metta Sutta, remembering words from that, but really taking it up as a practice, because as beautiful as the words are, and as much as we're in sesshin, we take them into ourselves because we are open and sensitive to them. Putting them in practice is, of course, the key. Another word for patience, and perhaps we mentioned this morning, I don't recall, is forbearance. Just forbearance, just being, another phrase for it is just being with. Can I just be with this? However you would say that to yourself. Just being with this. Even when somebody's accusing you of something you didn't do, this is hard. This is very hard. Or someone misunderstands you deeply and is hurt by something you said, and you know you did not intend that, and of course you know you can be unskillful, and etc. But trust in yourself, and just being with that feeling of well, this is tricky. So it's not that we just say these things by rote and we say, okay, I'm going to get into my forbearance practice, because we need that radical self-honesty to know when we're not just shutting it off, just saying, or being, oh, well, I have this undercurrent of, well, they just didn't get it. They just misunderstood. Or in other words, feeling sorry. It's in early Buddhism, it's considered the near enemy of compassion, you know, feeling sorry. You know, and that can be a subtle feeling, like, oh, they are suffering too. We are all suffering, but really trying to get in touch with the deepest. And I know you probably all know this and can go out and practice it. So just being here to remind ourselves that it's always available to us. I remember this from Koban. I'm not sure where I got it or heard it or read it, but bring in difficult people. I think one of Koban's students, perhaps Angie, told me that, you know, bring in the difficult people. Certainly Angie had a lot of stories about putting Jikoji together, from buying the land and et cetera to the people who used to live on it, who were difficult, who were very difficult. And then perhaps maybe too, remembering in ourselves that anger can come from a deep sense of helplessness when we feel overwhelmed by, when we feel overwhelmed by the world. And especially this is kind of activists are kind of prone to this. I remember when I was young or at that age in the late 60s and early 70s, in 1970, I believe I joined the Peace and Freedom Party because, you know, we were marching in the streets. We were doing things, not that I was a real front of the lines marcher, but I was with my students and friends and colleagues. So I thought, yes, the Peace and Freedom Party. That sounds like the ticket. You know? And I went to some of those meetings and I was really horrified and felt completely helpless. And I had known some personal anger in my family situation. And so these people were all over anger. They were not peace and freedom, at least not that I knew it, as I wanted to know it. I knew that they were not the peace and freedom that I wanted. So that helplessness. So then we each turn to what we can turn to, and we have these wonderful practices, and we have our way, the Bodhisattva way. And as I think, and as Kaveh mentioned the other day, there are many other ways too. Others have their way, and our way is just our way. We have to be true and faithful to that, but it's not the only way. To be open to hearing other people's way is also a way of alleviating anger. Okay, that's what I brought, and I'm very happy if you would bring something in yourselves.
You did mention metta, and it sounds like you have married Vipassana and Zen traditions to some degree. But when I was listening to you talk about the anger, and it's something that I continue to investigate and am blessed and cursed with a certain ferocity. When I hear patience, there's a certain resistance that I've met, and then I meet with that with a should. You should not be angry. You should be, you know. And what I found is with the metta practice and through the Santa Barbara Zen Center, we've been reading Sharon Salzberg's book, that, and I think even the word antidote has been used, but that there's such a gentleness there, and there's such a welcoming. So there's anger, there's aversion, there's ferocity, and it doesn't have the resistance around it. So I'm not sure where patience comes in here. Does that make sense?
Yes, these are all qualities of mind and heart, and yet and they do get intertwined. And we do come from a kind of a should culture. some other cultures aren't so much that way. So the gentleness, well, Sharon Salzberg, she was my metta teacher. I did metta retreats with her years ago, and just do metta. That's all you did all day. So that's where I got that practice to carry into the world. I mean, it gets very, like Sashin, it's very, gets strong. But not that you don't forget, and not that you don't get angry, of course. But the patience, I guess I would say this, it's a way of just, two kind of metaphors come, way of just, well, taking a breath or just settling into yourself. And Shanti Davis way is like examining what that is doing for you when you can step back rather than it being a should. It's also a parami in the early tradition, in the Vipassana tradition. So it's a different order, but they also have these qualities of perfections. That's kind of what the word means in Sanskrit. So also the, it is aligned with particularly in metta, which is a general term for the Brahma Viharas. So there's metta's great friendliness. And then there's the next one is karuna, compassion. So it's very aligned, the patience with compassion. So maybe, and compassion for oneself. That we start always with ourselves. I mean, in the early text, Buddha said, you are deserving of your own compassion. You are deserving of your own love, if you will. So rather than being a should, it's a going, which I think of should as a gate, as going back. It's a going, it's opening the gate. It's going forward and going out. So I'm not sure if that was helpful, but that's what I could say about that.
I don't want to argue with Shanti Deva, but I have to say that maybe it's a generational thing, but, you know, women of my era were not really allowed to be angry. And I think that anger has its place. I don't think necessarily, I consider anger a friend. It usually shows me something I have to look at, and I want to look at it, because there's meat on that bone that I need to make friends with. Now, I do think that how one responds could be really, you know, unskillful and hurtful and dangerous. And, you know, I think there has to be a big pause in the response to what arises. But I guess I have found my anger to be really part of my intuition. Like, okay, something's here, something's to look at. It doesn't mean I have to go on to a huge narrative about where it came from or anything. It's just like, this is meeting this moment right here by looking at this anger. So I don't really want to separate it out, I guess, from everything else. They all are, for me, they're all, it's all a gift.
Well, thank you. He also says it's a gift. So in a way, you're not arguing with him. I don't know, I can't tell, especially on screen, what generation anybody is, but I certainly came of age in that era where, and I do think there are many there are many, you touch on very important and deep things. And that's part of why I quoted Muriel Rukeyser, who is a woman who also was a a few generations back, but still was very aware of the cultural, historical condition under which women live. And certainly Buddhism has its own huge baggage about that, but which has only been addressed recently, very recently. So I remember when Angie and a few women at San Francisco Zen Center and a few independent little centers like Floating Zendo just said, no, we have to at least put Mahapajapati in here. You know, so that's a very recent history. And those intuitions, so calling anger has also a quality, and particularly in the Tibetan, they look at this, of clarity. And so there can be cold anger. And so it's also, again, I would say what Deborah brought in, it is altogether, but it's tricky not to slip over. So that's where we have to really trust ourselves. And so thank you for bringing that in, Pamela.
In talking about anger and patience, I think it's also important to be patient with ourselves when we are in anger. I think anger is a deep, deep message from the body. When I am in anger, I am in stress hormones and all kinds of chemicals that completely wipe out my rational thinking. And in a way, I think it's a strong, strong message. And so what Pamela is saying about paying attention, I think is really, really important. And for me, especially after the adrenaline rush, it can take me a long, long time to release the anger, let go of the anger, let go of the ego wound that I experienced when I didn't feel heard. So I guess in a sense, like Deborah said and Pamela said, it's all of the above. And yet it's a very strong, very, very strong emotion. And hopefully we can have enough patience to live long enough to let it dissipate and see our part in it and see its message to us. So I guess that's just my take on it, that it's not just being angry with the situation or person who brought up that bodily sensation in me, but also to be patient and kind to myself for having that instantaneous response.
Thank you. There can be, I'm really glad you both brought these things in. There's a place, and I relate to them and have felt those sensations. And it also depends on the situation, what kind of wound there is, or what kind of, and Pamela's great phrase, meat on the bone, what needs to be really looked at or chewed on here. And yet also being in the moment, some situations with an anger of clarity, we have enough bodhicitta or practices that we've done that we can still make the compassionate response to other or, you know, and to ourselves. And so we can hold all of that. Thank you. Karen.
I'll follow Kathy since she brought up the body, and I feel I feel like I'm a very physical person, and one really great advantage of this virtual session is that I have been breaking form, and during the Kenhin, I'm jumping on my mat and really working with the places that are emotions. It feels like I feel like the anger is a place in my hips and in my outer legs. And also grief. I felt a lot of grief, and I feel it right between my shoulder blades. And it's been so amazing to sit and then work on it, and then come back and sit. And I don't actually know how anybody doesn't do that between and just because it's. For some reason, my body is taking a long time to be able to sit in Seishin, and I really have needed the yoga. But at this particular time, I feel so connected between when, you know, like I felt such a really, there's been a repetitive grief of an event that's been repeating and repeating for a long time. And now I felt it, and I felt it like this vibration right across here. And I just let it almost like, what note is that? And it was like this vibration right here. And then I just let it be. And it felt like it just got really universal. And anyway, so that's just another approach.
Thank you, Karen. Yeah. Getting to know ourselves, yeah. Getting to know what energy is. At the end, it's all we are is energy.
Yeah.
We're just energy. Yeah. So there's a place we're going to come to at the end of Shantideva. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that quite poignant story. Really wonderful. Thank you.
Coming back to Pamela's statement, reminded me of the precept. We have a precept of no being angry, or no being anger, which is how it's translated sometimes, no embodying anger. The Colvin translation of that precept is self nature is mysterious and profound. In the midst of equality, in the midst of one dharma, not to give rise of measuring of self and others is the precept of no being angry. And that term measuring kind of confused me for a while, but later I understood it like a mind that compares one thing to another. So if I'm angry at myself for something, there's a comparison between my idea of what I should have done and what I actually did do. And it can be really, really fast. So fast that you actually miss that measuring. And I think what Pamela was referring to is like, even if it's afterwards, it's a opportunity to have some insight into the source of the anger, which is this measuring mind, this comparing mind, this evaluating mind that says one thing is better than another. If we can have an insight into that, then anger can be our teacher.
Thank you, Mike. For bringing Coben in, I haven't seen that translation. I appreciate hearing it and your understanding of it.
Been very fruitful for me to look at the overlay of numbness, maybe we'd say, or just an unwillingness to go deep enough to deal with the issue, or just, you know, a lifetime of those issues of not being able to speak up or not being able to identify the level of anger. And so it's very helpful to see the nuances here, and just would be helpful to get to that understanding of it's a lack of, what would it be? There's an opportunity and there's an obligation to go forward with our practice, with these understandings, so that even though we don't want to deal with old stuff or it's too painful to go there, it's a form of bypass. It's a form of spiritual bypass to just say, oh, I'll be patient. Because there has to be some way to address it with skill. First for ourselves, and then for whatever family members, if that's the case, whatever one's still around to do it with, or whatever has to be done. A lifetime of stepping around it is not patience. It's not the antidote. I don't think it's unskilled patience, or poorly named. And so I look forward to looking at it with courage and the new ways of viewing it.
Thank you, Susan. So selecting one word out of many in language, which you point out so beautifully, that by looking at different ways, finding one's own different words, forbearance and or with courage, patience with courage, what that's beautiful, whatever we need to do, going deeper. It's always going deeper. And I would say broader. It's always going deeper and broader. So it's time to do some Kinhin and some Dokusan. So shall we say our vows? May-
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.